Hi, this is Karen Schomer, formerly of The Schomer Show. You're listening to WGXC Acra 90.7 FM.
Tune in to all sorts of creative community voices on the radio Monday, November 28th on WGXC, including at 9 a.m. We hear from Yvonne Taylor of the Seneca Lake Guardians about the grassroots effort to get Governor Kathy Hochul to sign the first in the nation cryptocurrency mining moratorium. That happened last week, and Yvonne Taylor will tell us about it on the WGXC Morning Show. Then at 10 a.m. on the Afrosonic Taxi, we're hearing music from Molly. At noon, after the local news, it's time for the Deep Three Show, with works this week from Rafael Pidal, McCoy Tyner, and Heinz Sauer, among others. At 2 p.m., the Vital Weekly Show has new music from around the world, including tracks this week from Milton Babbitt, Mikhail Kuhn, and Susana Santos Silva. Then Pamela Z is the featured artist, 3 p.m. on the Tracking the Odds show from Roulette Intermedium in Brooklyn. 4 p.m. we're live from Western Massachusetts with Kieran Riley hosting the WGXC afternoon show. And at 8 p.m. for evening music, Rob Van Erv from Valencia has Everything All the Time at 8 p.m. on 90.7 FM WGXC. New York's Museum of Firefighting hosts a snowball that they promise will be copyright-free, with the Snow Sisters Elsa and Anna singing songs and dancing, photographing, and more. It's a morning of holiday fun for the kids, December 10th at New York's Museum of Firefighting in Hudson. Find out more on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided by the First Presbyterian Church of Hudson, a faith community open to all. Whether you are single, married, divorced, gay, wealthy, poor, or no habla inglés, if you are just browsing, just woke up, or just got out of jail, it doesn't matter if you work on Wall Street or if you sleep on Wall Street, you belong. We love soccer moms, crying babies, vegans, hipsters, seekers and doubters, tourists and locals. All are welcome. Services held Sunday mornings at 10:45 a.m. You can find us on the web at firstpreshudson.org.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of Cochrane Media of Cairo, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate. Thank you for your support.
Give me liberty! Or give me death!
WGXC, the station that gives you liberty.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC Newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that the State Commission on Judicial Nomination last week submitted seven candidates for Governor Kathy Hochul's consideration as she reflects on who should lead the state's top court and its court system. By law, her nomination will be made between December 8th and December 23rd. Potential top judges for the New York Court of Appeals include a sitting member of the court, Associate Judge Anthony Canataro. Additional nominees include Yale Law School Professor Abby Gluck, Appellate Division President Justice Hector LaSalle, Albany Law School Dean Alicia Quillette, Deputy Chief Administrative Judge for Justice Initiatives Edwina J. Richardson Mendelson, Associate Justice of the Appellate Division Jeffrey Oing, and Corey L. Stalton, the attorney in charge of the Legal Aid Society. The commission is a body composed of panelists appointed by the governor, legislative leaders in the state Senate and Assembly, and the chief judge. E. Leo Milanus, the commission chair, said, quote, that so many exceptional candidates were motivated to apply demonstrates the remarkable strength and depth of the legal profession in the state of New York, unquote. Chief Judge Janet D. Fiore stepped down in August after 6 years on the job. The chief judge of the Court of Appeals is appointed to serve a 14-year term. Read more about the story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. Andrea Macco reports for Porcupine Soup. Voters in the Greenville Central School District go to polls on December 6th to decide the fate of a $14.48 million capital project. The improvements are focused largely on Scott M. Ellis Elementary School and will have no additional tax impact on district residents. District Superintendent Michael Bennett said the process began in mid-2021 with a building condition survey as well as feedback from various parties. Quote, past projects put a focus on the middle and high schools, as well as the athletic fields. For this project, we're shifting focus to the elementary school, unquote, Bennett said. The total cost of the project is $14.48 million. District officials say the project will not increase taxes because retiring debt payments from a previous project will be used to fund the work. New York State building aid will cover approximately 72% of the project, with the remaining amount covered locally. That local share, totaling $2.6 million, will come from the Capital Reserve account. The second of two public information sessions on the project will be held on November 29th. Polls will open from 3 p.m. to 9 p.m. on December 6th. If the proposal is approved, work is expected to begin in May of 2024. Read more about this story at porcupinesoup.com. Columbia Green Media reports a 92-year-old truss bridge in Kinderhook will be closed for a month to allow for needed repairs. The bridge that carries County Route 21 over the Kinderhook Creek is scheduled to be closed beginning November 28th to fix the steel trusses, officials at the Columbia County Commissioner of Public Works office said. The bridge was originally scheduled to be closed beginning November 21st, but was postponed for a week. The bridge will be closed to all traffic, including pedestrians and bicycles, while the work is being performed. Motorists who normally use County Route 21 to drive to Kinderhook are being asked to follow posted detour routes, which will send drivers along Route 9 and Route 9H. The work will run through December 30th, according to the electronic message boards. The most recent inspection of the bridge in 2021 found it to be in poor condition, but it was allowed to remain open with no restrictions. The two-lane, 119.4-foot-long span was built in 1930. Maintenance was last done on the bridge 20 years ago. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com. And read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at WGXC.org.
Biden must demand freedom for Alaa Abd El Fattah. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast, Cairo, Egypt. There are dictators in the world who wield absolute power. Then there are U.S. senators. Very few understand the power these 100 individuals hold in the world's most powerful country. A single senator can effectively block any legislation. They don't need to give a reason and often do it entirely in secret. President Joe Biden, who is a senator for decades, knows this and also knows he needs the vote of every Democratic senator to pass critical appropriations during Congress's current lame duck session. Democratic Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy, the longest-serving senator currently in office, is retiring on January 2nd after 48 years. He's been a champion of human rights, authoring the Leahy Law that denies U.S. aid to human rights-abusing regimes. Senator Leahy or one of his colleagues could make a vital difference and save lives by blocking any bill in this session that shores up human rights-abusing governments. Take Egypt. The U.S.-backed Egyptian dictator, President Abd El Fattah el-Sisi, rose to power after a military coup in 2013. His image is omnipresent in this sprawling capital city of 20 million, on buildings, lampposts, and across the mass media, which is effectively controlled by the state. More than 60,000 political prisoners are locked up here. The true number is unknown. The most prominent is Alaa Abd El Fattah, a writer, technologist, and leading activist in the 2011 Arab Spring Revolution that overthrew Egypt's previous long-standing U.S.-backed dictator, Hosni Mubarak. Yet Alaa, a dual Egyptian and British citizen, has been in prison for most of the last decade. His case received global attention when Egypt hosted COP27, the UN climate summit in Sharm el-Sheikh. Alaa had been on hunger strike for more than 200 days at a desert prison. As COP27 began on November 6, he escalated his protest, refusing to drink water altogether. Last week, Alaa told family members in their first prison visit in nearly a month that he suffered a near-death experience that week. The German chancellor, the French president, the British prime minister, and President Biden had all raised his case directly with Sisi. prison authorities medically intervene secretly to avoid the crisis his death during COP27 would have provoked. The Sisi regime survives largely thanks to massive support from the United States. Egypt receives $1.3 billion annually in military aid, with an additional $125 million plus in economic aid. Egypt has long been the second highest recipient of U.S. foreign aid after Israel. Its support is delivered through annual congressional appropriations, subject to verifiable compliance with human rights standards. The U.S. State Department oversees this massive aid package with the Pentagon. As part of the process, the State Department is required to produce a human rights report on Egypt. Its most recent 72-page litany of horrors includes extrajudicial killings, forced disappearances, torture, and cruel inhuman treatment, life-threatening prison conditions, and arbitrary detention. The list goes on. While any rational reading of the report would result in the denial of aid, the State Department routinely invokes a national security waiver, authorizing the aid despite the rampant abuses.
You train their police officers. You train their army officers.
That's Leila Swaif, Ala Abdel Fattah's mother, a math professor and renowned activist in her own right. She was speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour during an exclusive interview with her daughter in their family apartment in Cairo.
This whole operation is a U.S. operation. The helicopters they use to track people in the desert. This is U.S. This whole Sisi thing is a U.S. security operation. But it really, yes, the U.S. can decide if they want to, that they want the regime to do this and not do that.
Ala's family has been tirelessly advocating for his release at great risk. His youngest sister, Sana, 28 years old, has already been imprisoned for over 3 years for her activism.
The U.S. has stakes in that regime, stakes in that oppression, and so has responsibility.
That's Sana Saif speaking on Democracy Now!, sitting next to her mother.
It's not leverage. Leverage is as if you're not a stakeholder in this. You are part of this, and you are a big part of this. You send $1.3 billion of military aid to Egypt every year.
President Biden was photographed with Sisi at COP27 laughing with the dictator. Sisi has also been invited to next month's U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit at the White House. Like any Western-aligned autocrat seeking legitimacy, Sisi is reportedly seeking a one-on-one meeting with Biden. President Biden should work for the immediate release of Ala Abdel Fattah and many more Egyptian political prisoners before granting Sisi a plum White House meeting. Meanwhile, Senator Patrick Leahy, as one of his proud last acts in office, along with other senators, should block further Egyptian military aid until Ala is free. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan in Cairo, Egypt.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre, and you've tuned into the WGXC Renewable Weather Forecast for Sunday, November 27th. And we start each renewable weather forecast with the price of fossil fuels in Greene County. The Citgo in South Cairo has gas for $3.75 a gallon. That's the lowest, according to the Gas Buddy website. And the air quality forecast is a 12, virtually the same as Saturday. And the UV index is just 1 for Sunday. That is on the low end. National Weather Service in Albany says there's a 100% chance of rain on Sunday, mainly after noon, with a high of 48 and a wind from the south 5 to 8 miles per hour with gusts as high as 20 miles per hour spinning local windmills. Sunday night, the rain is supposed to continue. There's a 90% chance. With another windy night, wind gusts could be as high as 28 miles per hour on Sunday with a low temperature of 39 degrees. Monday, there is a chance of showers in the morning. Then it's just cloudy with a high of 44 and a northwest wind 11 to 14 miles per hour with gusts as high as 29 miles per hour for those windmills. Monday night is partly cloudy with a low around 27 and a northwest wind 5 to 9 miles per hour after midnight. Tuesday should be sunny with a high of 42 and a low around 31. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar-powered radio for open ear.
We're joined by Yvonne Taylor, who is the vice president of Seneca Lake Guardians. And as many people probably have heard by now, Governor Hochul finally has signed the bill to oppose a two-year moratorium on any new cryptocurrency mining operation using what's called proof of work here in New York. So Yvonne is one of the, you know, people really fought to get this moratorium enacted. Why is this so important?
It's so important because we are in the middle of a climate crisis. And to imagine repowering or expanding decommissioned or underutilized fossil fuel burning power plants in New York State or anywhere else for that matter, simply to provide power to mine for cryptocurrency felt literally insane.
And I mean, how, you know, big is the climate, you know, impact? And I guess it's a particular way of doing it, you know, cryptocurrency, where you basically have people sign a mathematical equation in order to create the crypto coin. What type of impact are we actually talking about?
Right. It's not all virtual currency that uses this proof of work model, but the proof of work model, they call it also cryptocurrency mining. And the mining isn't what most people think of when you take, you know, excavation equipment and dig into the ground. The mining is done by machines that are highly specialized for this work. The problem with it is that it requires an extraordinary amount of energy, comparable to some countries like the size of Argentina. And so that's why some of these miners have decided that the best way to do it is to buy up a power plant to fuel the energy that they need. But because it's so energy consumptive, it's an industry that is really bad for the climate. And there are other forms of cryptocurrency that use models like, for example, proof of stake, that use 99% less energy than the proof of work mining does.
Now, this moratorium applies to, you know, new permit proposals. It does not apply either to existing plants or to actually to plants already applied for permits. And one of the, you know, motivations from people out in Seneca Lake was this proposal related to Greenwich. Where does that one stand at this point?
Right. So the Greenwich power plant was a coal-fired power plant that was shut down and producing zero carbon emissions for several years and restarted again, not to provide power to the public, but to mine for cryptocurrency, which is how Seneca Lake Guardian got involved. The Greenwich facility was positioned ideally as a test case for how other decommissioned or underutilized power plants across New York State may become revitalized again. And so we brought it from being a test case to being the poster child for what not to do with power plants in New York State. And sadly, this moratorium that the governor just signed into law has no impact on the Greenwich facility because it is grandfathered in. However, the Department of Environmental Conservation did deny its Title V air permit renewal, which is a good sign for our bold climate law in New York. And we are working now to shut it down completely, along with the Fortistar plant in North Tonawanda, which is trying to follow the Greenwich model.
Now, this bill, I believe, was actually passed, you know, in late spring. So it took 5-6 months before the governor agreed to sign it, and actually, you know, took place a couple of weeks after she got reelected. Is there anything to read into, you know, why it was delayed this long? And this is a study bill. Do we know where the Hochul administration really is now, you know, standing on the issue of this type of cryptocurrency mining and its climate impact?
Right. Well, what you saw happen, Mark, was a major Herculean victory brought about by collaborating with grassroots environmental activists and organizations across New York State, and with the help of groups like the Sierra Club, Food and Water Watch, Earth Justice, NYPIRG, and Seneca Lake Guardian, we were able to get this bill passed at the 11th hour, and then ultimately signed by Governor Hochul, despite millions of dollars of investment by the pro-crypto industry, and you know, for not only campaign donations, but also major lobbying efforts by the industry. Despite all of that attempt by the industry to squash our efforts, you know, the bill was passed and Governor Hochul finally did sign it into law. I think that bodes well for her, you know, ultimate support of New York's bold climate law. And we hope that she will continue to demonstrate to be a leader on climate for the rest of the country.
Now, many of these type of crypto mining, you know, computer farms, I guess actually had been, you know, based in China, but China eventually decided that both the cryptocurrency itself was sort of a too speculative of a financial institution, but they were also concerned about the climate impact. So they began, you know, to push them out, and they migrated to the United States, but particularly also to upstate New York. Where is this issue standing right now, say, with the Biden administration? I kind of recollect they did put out some type of statement a while back, which seemed to acknowledge some real concerns about this issue.
That's right. New York is sadly not the only state impacted by cryptocurrency mining. As you mentioned, once China began to ban the practice, these miners moved by the droves to the United States, where it's spreading like a cancer across the country. And you're right, the Biden administration's Office of Technology and Science put out a very comprehensive statement suggesting that the energy intensive nature of this industry was incompatible with our country's climate goals. In addition to that, Earth Justice also put out an amazing comprehensive guide along with the Sierra Club for other communities and other states across the country who might be experiencing the harmful impacts of this industry. It's a wonderful resource that not only demonstrates the harmful impacts of this industry, but also refutes some of the major industry talking points. And it should be useful for anyone considering some kind of federal legislation against this industry.
Now, we only have about a little over a minute left, so I'm going to throw out a question and you take it where you want. One is, one of the things the industry argues, well, we can power these plants, these facilities with renewable energy. So, you know, we don't have to have this type of negative climate impact. And then also, if people want to get more information about this issue or keep involved, how best can they do that?
Thank you. Yes. You know, that was an appealing idea in the beginning, considering, wow, well, let's just power all of these mines with renewable energy resources. However, if you look at how much energy they consume, what it only does is it takes all of those precious green electrons away from the public where we really need it most in order to achieve climate goals. And it raises the cost and the accessibility of renewable energy resources for everyday people and businesses. So that notion, while it seems on the surface to be a good one, is not at all an ideal situation. We need to move into less energy intensive modes of cryptocurrency. If you want more information, please follow Seneca Lake Guardian on Twitter, Facebook, and go to SenecaLakeGuardian.org.
Thank you very much, Yvonne Taylor. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We have a special treat, and we are so blessed to have Dr. Marina Sorochinsky. She is an interdisciplinary scholar with a master's in forensic science, psychology, and PhD in psychology and law from CUNY. She is currently an assistant professor of criminal justice at St. John's University. Welcome, doctor. How are you?
Thank you so much, and I'm really happy to be here.
Thank you so much for stopping in. And how's the family? How's the kids?
They're wonderful. They're a handful, as usual.
Great. So let me dig right in then. So why the focus on wrongful convictions and serial cases specifically?
So we recently, myself and actually Dr. Matthew Johnson has first started this research in looking at and identified some of the cases that there's basically a trend where in a lot of series we find, well, actually a lot of wrongful convictions, proven wrongful convictions are actually cases that were part of a series. So in other words, an individual gets wrongfully convicted for a crime that is actually part of somebody else's series of crimes. So not just a single crime, but a whole series. And it's a big problem because when somebody gets wrongfully convicted, the true perpetrator remains out. And okay. So they actually have a chance to continue with their series. They actually have a chance to victimize more people. So it is even more of a problem than somebody who gets wrongfully convicted for a single crime where, you know, there's no continuation. So it's a really important topic, I think.
Okay, great. We got a lot to unpack, so I want to keep it moving here. What are those investigative challenges? How are they different from other cases of WC, wrongful convictions?
So in serial cases, the investigative challenges are particular because in addition to regular, you know, understanding, figuring out who done it, the challenge is determining the linkage. So linkage blindness is part of why somebody gets wrongfully convicted in the serial crime, because if the investigators didn't figure out quickly enough that this crime is actually not a one-off offense, but instead part of a series, and they investigate it as a one-off offense, they basically are running a risk of completely kind of taking the investigation in the wrong direction.
Okay. You might want to tell the people in the household that you are live on air, because we can hear them very clearly in the background. All right.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. That's right. Look, this is a working house. We totally understand. So who are your students, and do they know about your wrongful convictions before they come into your class?
Sorry, I have a baby, so
listen,
that's always a problem.
You get a free pass. You hear me, Doc? All right. So as I was saying, who are your students, and do they know about your wrongful convictions before they come to your class?
So because I teach in a criminal justice program, most of my students are planning to go into either criminal justice administration or continue on their studies in law school. So these are basically the future of our legal and criminal justice system. And surprisingly enough, very many of them don't know nearly enough about wrongful conviction, even though it's been out in the media quite a bit in the recent years. Many of them find it very surprising when I discuss those issues and find it, you know, eye-opening, the degree to which our system is not doing.